This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with the Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist from The Advocate, Walt Handelsman. Also on the show, Jim Brown, the longtime Louisiana politico, former Secretary of State, former insurance commissioner, and state senator. On what's happening in the political world with an election less than 7 weeks away, Jim Brown was also the publisher of Edwin Washington Edwards' book written by Leo Honeycutt. And Edwin Edwards is in another race, as we know. And what are his chances? We'll discuss it with Jim Brown. Mary Landrieu also in the hunt for a fourth term against strong opposition from the Republican ranks. Bill Cassidy and Rob Manus are trying to take the prize away from Louisiana's senior senator. We'll talk about it when we return after this brief pause for the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside our area. Please call 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. And you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Our leadoff guest, Walt Handelsman. He is the editorial cartoonist for The Advocate in Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Lafayette, and parts unknown. And he is a Pulitzer Prize winner for editorial cartooning in 1997. He won journalism's greatest honor while working for the Times-Picayune and then did it again in 2007 with Newsday. So he is one of the most talented people in his field. And if you picked up your Advocate today, there is a Walt Handelsman cartoon on the editorial page. And good morning to you, sir. Nice to talk with you again.
How are you, Jim?
Doing great. And you churn out quite a few of these. How many a year do you do?
You know, I probably do close to 300 a year. I do four a week for The Advocate, as well as some cartoon caption contests, which we've been doing here, which turned out to be one of the more popular things that we do. It's a lot of fun. People really like those. And then I've been producing an animation that runs on their websites just about once a month. So it's a constant, it's a little cartoon factory over here.
Well, yeah, and you've done it a long time, and some might think it's hard to keep those juices flowing, but people change, and there are always new people. A decade ago, Barack Obama was largely unknown, but now he is, of course, leader of the free world and has been for 6 years, and he's one of those guys. You capture him in all his majesty. He's a handsome man, but in a Walt Handelsman cartoon, he comes across as with a man with a long face and big ears.
Well, you know, he does have a long face and big ears. And the funny thing is, his predecessor also had big ears. So I was starting to wonder if maybe there was a little trend there in the White House. Although his predecessor had a long chin. So, yeah, I started doing this as a kid, really, when Ronald Reagan was first elected. And so I've had a chance to draw all of these guys throughout the years. And I think before my career is over, I'll probably have a chance to draw a woman in the White House. Yeah. And you ask, you know, people always ask, how do you get the ideas? But as you said, I mean, the cast is constantly changing. And, you know, now that I'm back in Louisiana, the cast and the script for this has really widened. And it's just, you know, it's not only fun, but it's also, I think, important to be able to, you know, look at the same news that people look at every day and to be able to poke fun at these people. I try and do it in a pretty gentle way. Occasionally it's a little harsher, but you know, I think it's an American tradition to have cartooning, free speech, to have people you know, look at someone in their daily newspaper poking fun at the folks in Baton Rouge, in New Orleans, around Louisiana, and of course around the world. It's a real honor to be able to do it.
In Sunday's Advocate, there is a long-faced, big-eared President Obama saying a coherent ISIS strategy will disrupt their command and control and send them into a frenzy. And then there's another cartoon of the president saying, but enough about the Republicans. I'm sure sometimes you hit a nerve that some people don't like.
Well, you know, who wouldn't like that cartoon? I mean, if you're a Democrat, then you're going to look at that cartoon and you're going to say, yeah, it's about time that the president figured out a way to stick it to the Republicans. In that cartoon, he did that. If you're Republican, then you're thinking, well, that's probably part of why he's doing this. So I'll tell you, Jim, the business of cartooning and commentary and reaction and interaction between readers has changed so much since I first started in the early 80s. It's really dramatically changed. Whereas, well, for one thing, as we all know and we talk about a lot, the country has changed a lot. There's a lot more arguing and criticism of the political parties between each other and by their supporters, at least in our face criticism, than there was years and years ago. And the same thing is true of cartooning. Now people can put an instant comment on the web anonymously, whereas before, if someone wanted to call, it kind of, you know, they had to find your phone number, and then they had to decide they were going to call the actual person and kind of yell at them. Now, that's happened many times, don't get me wrong, but it's a lot different now. So, you know, the job of the cartoonist is not to please. The job of the cartoonist is to poke fun at the powerful. And hopefully, you know, my theory on this is that there's enough going around on both sides to have fun with it. There are some cartoonists who strictly support the Democratic line and some that strictly support and tout the Republican line. I think that's not the way to go. That's not how I feel about life or politics. I don't do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Walt Handelsman is an equal opportunity basher or praiser, depending on your point of view. Here's one yesterday with Hillary Clinton running. No, I'm just Biden, B-I-D-E-N, my time, with Hillary standing atop the vice president, Joseph Biden. And Hillary, you capture her in her majesty, but as I look at her, she has narrow shoulders, broad hips, and big legs. Now, some would say that's not nice to do that to a lady, especially one of renown like the former Secretary of State, but she is a rather large presence.
Well, I mean, I think she's not large. I mean, she's kind of a short woman, and she's not a big stature, but I mean, look, She, unlike Barack Obama, Barack Obama is tall and thin. People could look at my cartoon of him when he's in his suit walking and say, well, nobody's that skinny. You're making him look like a wimp. You know, the general focus of the caricature has to include the body. I certainly didn't make her obese because she's not. But I put her in the little green pantsuit, and that's just the way it is. I remember when I drew Bill Clinton for years, I drew him really big because part of the caricature had to be the narrative that this guy used to love to jog to McDonald's and have food. And when he started losing weight, I kind of refused to change because it really looked funny. It looked fun. It was funny the way I drew it, and it was fun to draw it that way. But you really have to caricature the whole thing. You know, the way that they speak, their body, their hair, and you have to exaggerate. So, you know, I'm sure that supporters of Hillary or supporters of Barack Obama would have some criticism of the way that I draw him and her, but that's the way it goes.
Well, you do it well, and I don't think anybody would claim that your cartoon does not look like Hillary or does not look like the president. And my goodness, a guy like you, as talented as you are, you probably hate the fact that you missed out on Richard Nixon. He was a cartoonist bonanza, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was just going to mention, when you were talking about those specific cartoons, sort of the process, if you want to spend a second on that.
Sure, I think certainly.
People are somewhat interested in this. The way this works is that I basically get up in the morning and read the newspaper and look at several newspapers and go online. And I try and make a list of topics that I think people will be talking about around the kitchen table the next day. Some cartoonists really get into the nitty-gritty And I think that, you could look at some cartoons and wonder, maybe I missed something. I'm not sure I understand this topic. And I respect their work because they really expect the reader of an editorial page to understand what's fresh and what's new, and understand the minutia of the news. I don't prefer to do cartooning that way. I like to make it a lot broader than that and sort of bring people in. Anyway, the point I was getting to is that the cartoons that you see are ones that the editor and I have picked. I generally do anywhere between three and five sketches a day, and I send them to Peter Kovacs, who's the editor of The Advocate, and an old friend of mine. And we usually bat them around, and we either instantly agree that this is the right one for tomorrow, or we bat it around, or sometimes he'll call me. When he calls me on the phone, then I know he didn't particularly like any of my ideas, and we'll chit-chat about them. He is an excellent editor. He also is a person that can take very complex issues and make them kind of easy to understand. And he looks at a cartoon, and if he doesn't get it, or if I have to explain it to him, even the slightest bit, we just decide no. So when you see a cartoon in the paper, there's probably been two or three other choices. And some days, I think it's a real coin toss. And some days when a cartoon runs, I say, I wish I had done the other one. But going back to your original question about how many of these I do a year, I sort of, you settle in after many years and you realize that not every day is going to be a great cartoon, but you're going to make a great effort every day. So that is sort of the process of getting it into the newspaper and on the web for the readers.
297-5633 for Walt Handelsman, editorial cartoonist, two-time Pulitzer winner, who is the cartoonist for The Advocate. Dan downtown, good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Have you gained any inspiration from your predecessors like Oliphant, the late great Herb Lock with the Washington Post?
Who are your inspirations as far as editorial cartoons?
It's a great question, and those are two phenomenal cartoonists. When I was a kid, my mom and dad bought me a Herb Lock book. Herb Lock, of course, was the famed cartoonist for many, many years at the Washington Post. And for those of you who would like to know more about him, there's a really great HBO special, which I believe you can still get on Netflix, about his life. Just phenomenal, powerful editorial cartoonist. I watched that and I said to my wife, "Well, it's like watching professional golfers, and then I go out and hack it around the course. I mean, this guy was phenomenal." So the answer is, as a kid, I really did read a lot of Herb Lock stuff in his book. And I was also all of the cartoonists of my age, and I used to be, one of the youngest cartoonists. We joke around about that. I came into a class of cartooning about all of us were in our early 30s, and now I'm in my mid-50s. But Oliphant was a game-changer for editorial cartooning for all of us, because before Pat Oliphant, editorial cartooning was really sort of much more of a serious, non-punchline-driven business. There were lots of guys. I mean, if you look at John Chase's work, who is just a phenomenal cartoonist, I'm sure many of your listeners will remember him. He was not a punchline-driven cartoonist. He was witty and clever and tough. But Pat Oliphant came along, and all of a sudden it was like looking at a Mad Magazine cartoon. They were hilarious drawings with really caustic, funny punchlines. So those two guys were big influences on everyone. Jeff McNelly, who was a little bit younger than both of them, was a phenomenal influence on all of us. Jeff unfortunately died more than 10 years ago was a young man. But he, again, is an artist that was unmatched. He won 3 Pulitzer Prizes. He really should have won every single year, and not a single cartoonist in the business would have said, "Well, how did that happen?" He was that good. So, cartoonists have influenced us.
Yeah, and you lost a great one this week, and we'll talk about that when we return with Walt Handelsman. 297-5633, a few more minutes with Walt, and then we'll hear from the incomparable Jim Brown when we return after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. A bit more time with Walt Handelsman, the two-time Pulitzer winner who does editorial cartoons for The Advocate. 877-217-5757. If you're outside the area, Ross and Gonzalez, you're on with Walt Handelsman. Hi, Ross.
Hi. Walt, I enjoy your drawings a great deal. I like both the gesture and the line quality in your drawings. And the reason I say that is because I'm a professor of art, and I teach drawing. And I was just wondering what kind of pen you use and what kind of ink. That's my question. I'll take
now
the
Now we're getting
the
into the nitty-gritty of it. See this, Jim?
Yeah, there
this
you
is,
go.
This is real cartooning. No, actually, I use these Lumicolor black markers, like a fine Lumicolor marker, and mostly I use a rotary rapidograph, two different sizes, to do my lettering and to do the caricature, the fine line in the caricature, and then I use everything. I have crayons and big fat magic markers and half burned out magic markers. So that's to do the pen and ink, which takes a couple of hours, and then I put the whole thing into the computer and color it in Photoshop.
Well, as I mentioned, you lost a giant in your business this week, a man who was also a Pulitzer winner. And by the way, these Pulitzer Prizes are not easy to come by, and the fact that Walt's won two of them makes him one of the most decorated editorial cartoonists of all time. Many great ones never win one Pulitzer, but your colleague in Philadelphia died this week, and I know you had to admire his work. He was a pretty good one.
He was great. He was Tony was we still have a cartoonist convention every year, which had the opportunity to meet Tony on several occasions there. He was kind of in the class a little bit older than I was, 20 years older. In the Jeff McNelly class of cartooning, if you will. A very sweet guy. And two things stand out to me about his work. One is the line. We just had an art professor or instructor call and ask about the line or what do I use. Tony Off had a very particular and distinct line. It was very thin. There wasn't a lot of super shading backgrounds and everything else, but it was very distinct, unique to him. But more importantly, his cartooning was very, very powerful. When I talk about my cartoons being more punchline-driven, Tony was the opposite. And there's sort of a break, sort of a split in the editorial cartooning world about which is the correct approach. I've always thought that the correct approach is whatever comes from your gut and that makes a point. But anyway, Tony used a very fine line and was a very powerful cartoonist. He did some phenomenal work, and I believe he won his Pulitzer during the Nixon era and the Nixon sort of collapse. One cartoon in particular that I remember of his was an aerial view of the White House. And if you can picture the shape of the White House with the portico, kind of the rounded part on one side and the flat part on the back, and he created a reel-to-reel tape recorder out of that shape, representing Watergate. It was just a brilliant cartoon. It was so simple, but it was a brilliant cartoon. And there were lots and lots of them. He did not shy away from controversy. And he is definitely one of the titans of the business of editorial cartooning. And we were all, word spread very quickly through the cartooning family that he had passed away. And it was sad, very, very sad.
72 years old, Tony Auth, an anchor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's editorial page. And he, like Walt Handelsman, reached a national audience. And we have a man of national stature in our midst, and Walt, who's on the pages of The Advocate most days, and we thank you for joining us today. It's always fun to talk with you, and I hope we do so again soon. Thank you, Walt. Thank you, Jim,
and I'd just like to thank the people that read The Advocate. We have we put a big effort into that. I have a great relationship with the folks in Baton Rouge, and it's been real fun. It's great to be back in Louisiana. I appreciate it.
We're glad you're back. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
And we're joined in studio by Jim Brown, former Secretary of State, former Insurance Commissioner, and former State Senator, and now a radio talk host, a columnist of renown, and a book publisher, among other things. He never stops, and he hasn't stopped running since he was a world champion relay member of a team that included Bob Hayes, Paul Warfield, and Ralph Boston many, many years ago. But
about 6 or 7 belt notches ago in the waist, Jim, I was pretty swift. But I went out to LSU the other day just to go visit and had to do some things on the campus, and I went out on the track with the fond memories of running, having had the chance to run all over the world. And I stood up against one of those hurdles. It looked like it came up above my head. I said, how on earth could I ever jump over those things some, 50 years ago, I guess, when I was running hurdles? So they're pretty intimidating today as I'm 74 years old, so I don't think I'd be much of a hurdle today.
You did it pretty well in your day, and Jim's still in pretty good shape. But he follows the world at large, and let's start first of all. I see where President Obama's top military advisor says he will recommend deploying U.S. forces in ground operations against Islamic extremists in Iraq if airstrikes prove insufficient. So where are we going? Is this deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra used to say?
Jim, it seemed pretty simple 11 years ago. The 9/11 attacks happened on America. We needed to respond, and therefore there was a consensus, right or wrong, and many people think today it's wrong to have gone into Iraq.
Well, many people thought it was wrong then.
Well, they did, but at least at least there was kind of two sides, and it was pretty clear. Today, the world has gotten so complicated. You just don't know who to trust. Not only externally, but internally within the information we're getting. Are we getting the information coming from the administration? The politics has gotten so heavy that Republicans attack Democrats. And so those of us sitting out here listening to your show and trying to live our lives are very, very confused about this complicated issue. I hope that Congress votes on it and there's a real solid debate, because if you get in, as Colin Powell said, boy, it's easy to get in, it's very difficult to get out. And we saw in Iraq, I think the cost of Iraq and Afghanistan today is reaching $7 trillion. I don't know what that means. I have no conception of what a trillion dollars is. But I know that we've got massive needs in this country. I want to be safe. But I also want to have a quality of life for my family in this country. So I'm like your listeners out there. It's very, very confusing. But I hope that we move cautiously and try to get all the information out on the table. And right now, there's lots of unanswered questions.
Isn't it curious that many of those who were the first in line to call for military action, the Dick Cheneys of the world, were last in line when it was their time to fight?
When Cheney was asked about why he didn't go ahead and serve, and I'm about Cheney's age, I volunteered to serve, didn't have to go in the military. And he said, well, he had other priorities. And I don't want to cast dispersion, but in Washington, they call them the chicken hawks, those who never serve but are the first to get us into war. And we've seen that true. The General Petraeuses and I mentioned Colin Powell and others are saying, let's move cautiously. But boy, the chicken hawks are, let's go, 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 let's jump into this war. We got a governor, Bobby Jindal, that says, man, let's just go in immediately and bomb them all and kill them all and slice off their heads and on and on and on, without thinking this thing through. So the only member of the military, by the way, in the Louisiana congressional delegation is Congressman John Fleming, a doctor who served in the Navy, volunteered to serve in the Navy. We don't have one other member, a senator or congressman, ever served a day in the military. And so and I know that as you go on, we didn't have the draft and quite the pressure, but my commendation to those like Fleming, that whether you agree with his politics or not, that went ahead and said, hey, I owe it to my country. Let me volunteer. Let me take a couple of years and give back. And so in any event, we have a lot of people who don't know anything about the military that want to jump into this thing. That's why I said, let's move cautiously. Let's let Congress vote on it. Let's be sure we have all the facts on the table.
But I don't know of anything that has solidified the U.S. Emotions in this country than the beheading of two Americans on foreign soil. That's something that I think no matter what your political stripes are, you got to be appalled about. And I think all of us want these people who did the beheading to be caught and perhaps to face the same kind of fate that they gave these two young men.
Except, Jim, let's don't go in on emotion. Let's go in on a concerted effort, and we know what we're getting into. It's horrible that those fellas, those two gentlemen, had their heads cut off. Terrible. We all are torn by that. But do we go ahead and spend another $7 trillion and kill 40,000 Americans because a couple of journalists went into a very dangerous area? Remember that, I did a little research on that very issue and found that if you were a journalist in Syria here in the last year, what you would say is, hey, I hope I don't see you in a YouTube video, which means I hope you don't get captured. It was a very dangerous place to be. And those journalists gave their lives and took a huge risk. And when you take risks, sometimes bad things happen. You know, I'm not going to go at 3 o'clock in the morning down to some drug infested part of the city and kind of hang out on a street corner. I'm taking a chance to do that.
I do that every now and then. I don't think I should be beheaded for it.
Well, and I don't want to minimize that at all. You're right. But having said that, how far do you go in response? Do we shut the country down and go to war and spend trillions of dollars over those two incidents? Or do you do a master plan to deal with terrorism that's a major problem for us and it's going to be for some time to come?
297-5633 for Jim Brown. As you can hear, a man who does not hold back when he is passionate on something, as he is about most things in American and Louisiana life. Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, and getting back to the subject about the two gentlemen that were beheaded, that reminds me of the fellows that were beheaded in Bataan Death March by the Japanese. Thanks.
The Japanese certainly beheaded people. I remember interviewing a prisoner of war, J. L. Gray, I believe was his name, and he said that they used to line them up. Jim Brown, these prisoners of war from the United States, and they would pick one of them and behead them right in front of everybody else, and then they'd make one of the other guys carry the head around for a day or two.
And Japan is now one of our closest allies. We have all types of economic relations. We have trade missions. Japan is one of our big buddies now, and yet beheaded not one or two, but thousands of Americans here just a matter of 60,
soldiers,
70 years ago.
Soldiers, not journalists.
Yeah, 70 years ago, right.
But you do have a point in that journalists sometimes go into danger zones, and I once... had a reporter say you never go into a danger zone with a photographer because just by instinct they go right to the action and invariably they're in a situation where they could get killed. And so
these guys
paid the ultimate price for trying to report on what's happening in the world.
And let's assume those two journalists had not been killed. Would the emotion be so high to rush in now if that had not happened? And so let's just don't act on emotion. Maybe we do go in and do the bombing, and maybe we end up putting boots on the ground. But let's do it based on what's in America's interest, what protects our safety, and not just rush in on emotion. That's the point I'm making.
297-5633, and a listener has already responded saying this is not an issue in the U.S. Senate race right now. I don't hear Bill Cassidy talking about ISIS or really are talking about anything right now other than running spots talking about Mary Landrieu's $2 million home, and I don't hear Senator Landrieu saying a whole lot about this. Why aren't the people who are seeking office in less than 7 weeks discussing this?
You know, isn't it a shame that our politics have delved down to a level where we don't talk about the future, we beat up on the past? Now, I know those are good political issues, where Mary Landrieu lives or what Bill Cassidy has done or not done. But what about the future? In this whole U.S. Senate race, I've not heard a word about where we go down the line in the future. In the 6th congressional district that's here in Louisiana, at least those candidates are talking about wetlands and talking about a variety of issues for the future, not in the past. This U.S. Senate race has bogged down into beating up on each other in terms of past activities, no vision for the future, nothing on foreign affairs, nothing on this war effort we're going into right now, nothing about the wetlands, nothing about energy. It's all about beating up and getting the edge. And I know there's a lot at stake in terms of the control of the Senate, but isn't it appalling that millions and millions of dollars are pouring into our state to tell us what to do by these outside groups and Cassidy and Landrieu are seeking the money out. They're running campaigns by primarily staying in Washington, running millions of dollars of TV spots, and they think that's the way to get to Louisiana voters. I'm appalled by it. I think it's the worst senatorial campaign I've seen in many, many years.
Well, I hate to bring the guy up, but you're familiar with Jonesville, Louisiana, right?
Oh, I know. I know Jonesville very well. I was the senator from Jonesville, Louisiana, back in the 70s.
I recall David Duke getting more than 1,000 people to show up in Jonesville once to hear him speak. And you just, this stump speaking, it's a lost art, isn't it?
It really is. And that retail politics is what we call it, I guess, if I'm still somewhat of a person in the political realm. But getting out there and meeting, you know, I've talked, you mentioned Jonesville. I talked to a few friends up that way not too long ago. They've never seen Cassidy. They've never seen Landrieu. No candidates come near them up there. And I know it's a smaller area, but I hear that in Shreveport, at Logansport, down in Houma. There'll be an occasional foray if there's a big festival or a major fundraiser. But candidates don't do that today. They don't get out and visit and respond to voters. And, Jim, I think that's a mistake. This race for the U.S. Senate is going to come down to about 4 or 5% of the population. And I think you get to a lot of those folks by retail politicking. And now somebody's going to win. But quite frankly, you can make a pretty good case of how neither one will win because of their strategies and their campaign. I think trying to buy this election is just a huge mistake and a real slap of the people of Louisiana.
Joe on I-10. Joe, good morning. You're on with Jim.
Good morning. Jim, I agree with you with regards to U.S. Planning to go to war with ISIS. And I think it would be good to have discussion with people like John McCain, who wants to go to war in every part of the world.
Now, McCain is the exception, a guy who was a warrior, who does seem to favor combat at every opportunity. Or almost every opportunity.
He does with his buddy Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. They're the real hawks, and of course McCain is not a chicken hawk like 90% of those beating the drum. He's a guy that is an American hero. You know, shot down as a pilot, served in a captured and served in a military prison, tortured, arm broken. That's why his arm reaches kind of funny. So I like John McCain, but again, he is. I think what's happened is he's gotten so enamored by his military background that rather than asking the tough questions and trying to get all the information out there, he's opinionating what he thinks we should do. I think he needs to listen a little bit more. I like the guy, but he doesn't listen a lot. He tells us what to do. And all these things change. There's variables. Let's listen to our military leaders, lay it on the table, and see what they have to say and make an informed decision. And I think that McCain is shooting for the hip a little too much.
Paul Sawyer, who was Richard Baker's top aide, one of our very smart listeners, says, Governor Jindal, he's quoting you, wants us to go in there and slice off heads, kill another 4,000 Americans. I realize Jim Brown is color commentary, but he should eschew this kind of prose. We'll return with Jim Brown, who is fired up. 297-5633, back after this timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your number. Jim Brown in house for a while longer, and Tyler on Florida. Good morning, Tyler. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just had a quick question. I was reading something recently on Democracy Now, and they were stating that a lot of the talking heads that are very pro-war actually have ties to the military-industrial complex and military, you know, organizations that want to go to war because they make money off of it. So I just was curious on your stance on that. Thanks.
All right.
Well, I don't think there's a war lobby per se, but there's no doubt about the fact that there is massive contributions from those who supply the weapons and those who build the planes, and there is a lot of heavy lobbying. I haven't seen signs they say they're lobbying to go to war, but I think they're lobbying for the fact that America's defense has to be built up. You've got to have our plane. We got to protect America. We got a Navy with aircraft carriers and more ships that travel throughout the oceans, and I'm glad we do, but in terms of our war effort, we don't need much along those lines. We're fighting a whole different kinds of war today. We've got these military planes that can do so very, very much. The drones seem to be working pretty well. well, and that kind of is a way of the future. But how much hardware do we need? I don't think it's more the war effort per se, as for our defense. We don't know what's happening in the future, so you better have these billion-dollar airplanes. You got to have this new aircraft carrier. And, of course, there's a vested interest in terms of the money doing that kind of thing. I think that that's an issue that has not been touched in this U.S. Senate race. All this money, you know, Louisiana's not funding the candidates in this U.S. Senate race. It is the defense contractors, and it is vested interests all over America. And now we're learning all over the world. A lot of these nonprofits and think tanks are putting money into our campaigns, and it's illegal for a foreign company or business to give money, but you can give it to a nonprofit who then funnels it into the think tank, who then gives it to the candidate. So money, I'll tell you what, you know what we should do? Jim, here's the best solution. Buddy Romer kind of alluded to it, bless his soul. No money outside the state of Louisiana. If you're running, or from wherever you're living, if you want to run for mayor of Baton Rouge, you don't get a dime unless it's inside Baton Rouge. If you're going to run for sheriff of Ascension Parish, only people in Ascension Parish can give you money. You're going to run for U.S. Senator, only Louisiana people support you. Wouldn't that be a refreshing idea, and not have this outside interest of millions and millions of dollars? Can you imagine the money that's going to be poured into this runoff for the U.S. Senate coming up here in December? From all over America. That's wrong. That's just not right. That's dead wrong.
Charles on North Foster. Good morning. You're on with Jim Brown. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, Jim and Jim. I have two quick questions. A quick comment. If we go after ISIS the way we're doing it, we're basically walking into a trap that they've set for us. My first question is, don't you think the Senate election is between the campaigns trying to paint Mary Landrieu with President Obama, whereas Bill Cassidy is trying to run from the Coke shadow that's all around him? And the second question is, if corporations have the right to free speech, shouldn't they have the right to serve, or shouldn't they be required to serve in the military?
And then if they're a citizen, you know, these corporations, they're asserting their right to be a citizen. Well, do citizens run off to other parts of the world and move all their operations over there so they don't pay U.S. taxes? You've raised some interesting questions, and that's the point that Jim made earlier, we talked about earlier. None of these kinds of questions are being debated. Maybe I don't have the right slant. I don't have all the answers. But I'd like to hear our candidates one of the most important offices in the world, the United States Senate, debate these issues, the outside money, the role of a corporation. Is a corporation a citizen? What are their responsibilities? Should they move offshore to save taxes? None of that's being discussed in this race. It's all beating up Mary Landrieu because of where she lives, and I think that's to some degree a legitimate issue. Or Bill Cassidy about something he did in the past when he was a doctor, back when he was a Democrat. They're not talking about the future, and let me tell you, I'm 74 years old. I don't have the future that a lot of you listeners do out that way, but I'm concerned about future for my kids and my grandkids. We're not talking about the future, and that's a huge mistake in this election. Shame on both those major candidates for running this kind of campaign.
Jim Brown, I don't know what you had for breakfast, but I want some of it. This man is he's ready to go fight a war right now. Here's a headline yesterday in the Daily Report. Jindal says Landrieu out of touch with Louisiana voters.
I saw that. Isn't that great? Here's a guy who's not been in Louisiana for most of the last 3 years, running a Don Quixote-type race for president around the country. I think he's getting 1% in the polls in Iowa right now. And yet he says that Mary Landrieu's out of touch. If any guy's out of touch, it's Bobby Jindal who's out of touch. Having said that, Jindal's making the point. He got on her about seniority because Landrieu was playing up the fact that she has all this seniority. And Jindal said, well, what do you got to show for it? I mean, point to something that really has benefited Louisiana, which I think is a pretty good knock, quite frankly. And the fact that she's out of touch, I think these issues may not be quite in depth in terms of where she lives, but it's an issue that to a lot of people feel like she's out of touch. The fact that she took, the count is up to about 40 airplane trips that were for campaign purposes, were paid for out of taxpayers' dollars. Is she out of touch? Those are pretty good issues, and those same issues resonate in Kansas right now, in Georgia, in a number of hot races that are going to determine the control of the U.S. Senate. So what's interesting to Jindal is he's popping Landrieu, but he's going around endorsing candidates for U.S. Senate and Congress all over America, but he's not touched the Louisiana
race.
No,
he hasn't endorsed Bill Cassidy, because David Vitter is closely tied to Congressman Cassidy, and they don't like each other. That is Scott Wilfong, the Republican consultant, said on this show the other day, is an untold story, is the aversion that Vitter and Jindal have toward one another. So,
well, you know, it has not served either one of them well. It would be in Jindal's interest, because of his future, mm-hmm. to have a relationship with Vitter. Vitter is running for governor. He may be elected. And it's in Vitter's interest to have a relationship with the governor right now, who still has a lot of support in terms of money raising. So, you know, sometimes you need to put your fight aside, but it's not. The fight has been going on for some time. I've heard various reasons why it is. I don't think it served either one of them well, though, quite frankly.
And Bill Cassidy, he chose sides when he fired Timmy Teeple and hired the Vitter campaign people like Joel DeGrotto to run his campaign, and he's definitely sided with David Vitter. And I heard commercials recently in the New Orleans area where Congressman Cassidy is in a spot saying, join me and Senator David Vitter, and we will fight illegal immigration.
I'm hearing
So yep. he's tying himself very closely to the junior senator from Louisiana. Phil on Jefferson Terrace, you're on with Jim Brown. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Hello, Mr. Brown. Yeah, I would agree with you about the corporation thing. On the, I mean, they're really not people. Do they like qualify for birth control? Or, it's really ridiculous, and it is not free speech to be able to throw money at an election. And I would point out that Mary Landrieu has brought in royalty payments to the state that are going to kick in somewhere down the line. I wish they would kick in sooner. And she and David Vitter got some legislation passed that would help, that helps out our coast.
Well, I'm sorry,
helps our coast.
I'll tell you what, though, in the scheme of things, if you look at the numbers, I you can't put this in Landrieu. We've got a whole congressional delegation. We go back to days when we had very powerful senators with Senator Long and Senator Johnson, and over all these years, the fact remains that what we've gotten for the coast is a pittance. Now, I don't know if this is going to happen, but some very legitimate coastal scientific experts involved with American Wetlands and some of these programs say that at the going rate we're dealing with right now, we're losing a football field of the coast every hour, and that by about 2050, there's a very good chance that Houma, Louisiana, and Morgan City will be underwater. And yet, we really haven't dealt with the issue. We're talking about $40 or $50 billion to really save our coast, and there's not been much interest out of Washington in helping us do anything like that. Is it Mary Landrieu's fault? I don't know. It's no one person's fault, but we've not been very successful. Seniority, in my opinion, has not particularly served us well in a variety of attributes. Steve Scalise is the new majority whip. That's great for Scalise. He'll be able to hire a staff of 50 people make, you know, help him in his attributes to be a big shot congressman. Does it help Louisiana? I don't really think so. I don't think the seniority effort. And if you look at the most effective folks out there getting the attention in Washington, Senator Ted Cruz, Senator Rand Paul, first-term senators that are making a heck of an imprint up there in Washington, D.C. So I really question the whole seniority argument, quite frankly.
What about the 6th District race? Edwin Edwards and 12 other candidates, the 12 apostles maybe?
Fascinating race. Edwards is a cinch to be in the runoff. I don't think it's out of the question he could win that race. It's a question of who he gets in the runoff with and what Cajun voters will do down the river saying, well, we're not crazy about the guy, but look at the alternatives. It's going to be the most fun race in the country, much more fun than the U.S. Senate race to watch in the runoff.
I was traveling to Thibodaux yesterday, and I noticed signs all along Highway 1 for Edwin Edwards for Congress. David on Highland. David, good morning. You're on with Jim Brown.
Hi. Good morning, sir. I just want to say, as a young voter, you know, I just turned 24 in July, I haven't really seen anything in the Landrieu or Cassidy ads that isn't painting each other as just wasting money or, you know, what they've done in the past. I have yet to see anything that would help the youth or focuses towards younger voters or trying to get their attention. Why do you think that is?
David, I think you're right on. I think they're both making a big, big mistake. You see several things as a younger voter. First of all, as far as what really interests you, it's the talk about your future. You're not concerned about what happened 20 years ago. You want to know what kind of quality of life you're going to have in Louisiana if you decide to stay here and raise a family. What's it going to be like 15, 20 years down the line? Nobody's talking about it. Number two, I think it's bad politics. Jim Inkster and I were talking earlier about the fact that Andrew and Casty are spending millions of dollars on television. I don't know how you get your information. I've got a 30-year-old son in New Orleans who never watches television, doesn't read the daily newspapers. He gets all his information off the internet. He's very well informed. But you can't find out a balance in terms of how these folks feel in terms of social media. They're not talking about the future, and David, they're not getting to people like you. I hope you'll still go vote. What I'm concerned about is a lot of young people say, they're just disgruntled. We don't like either one of them. Let's just don't bother to go vote. But I think this election is a lot more important to you than it is for people like me, quite frankly.
Well, Jim Brown, let's talk soon. You're right there in the heart of what's going on in our world, and it's going to be an interesting, let's see. We're 48 days away from Election Day now, so it's getting close.
Look forward to it, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. We're joined in our remaining moments by Renee Duffin. She is Vice President for Cancer Support and Outreach at Mary Bird Perkins, Our Lady of the Lake Cancer Center. Good morning, Renee.
Good morning.
Well, tell us about the bone marrow registration drive that's going on right now and how we can participate and why you believe this is essential.
Sure. Thank you very much for having us. We're very excited to be in partnership with Mayor Kip Holden, Mayor Burr Perkins, Our Lady of the Lake Cancer Center, and the National Bone Marrow Registry, Be the Match. And we have embarked on a 90-day donor challenge to try and encourage people throughout the Capital Region to register as bone marrow donors. And this is going to increase the number of individuals in the national registry and hopefully create more matches and save more lives in the long run. We embarked on this endeavor on August 12th, and it's going to run through November 1st. And we feel that this is essential and important in our community because bone marrow is a tool that is used to help treat cancer as well as other diseases. And we know that we have people here in Baton Rouge who could be a match for those who are waiting as well. And so we want to encourage people to come out and try to become donors. And we're looking for people between the ages of 18 and 44 and in good health. And we want to make sure that we get them. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes of your time to complete the paperwork and then do a quick cheek swab, and you're on the registry.
18 and 44, though, so if you're over 50, forget about it.
Well, if you're older than 44 years old, 45 or older, I think it's 45 to 64, you can go online to the Be the Match website and register that way, but there is a $100 fee to register.
So why are younger people sought after for this kind of thing?
Well, physicians feel that younger people make better donors.
Okay.
And so, you know, they're younger, they're healthier in most cases and that type of thing. They don't have comorbidities that could prevent them from becoming donors. And so that's why they've decreased the age to 18 to 44.
Well, when somebody becomes a donor, what is the process?
Well, if they become a donor and their information is put into a database at the National Registry, and if a person who is looking for bone marrow they run the database to see if there are any matches. If you become a match for someone, then there is a process in which you engage in. They do blood work, they do different testing, just to make sure that it is a perfect match for that individual. In most cases, if you are called to become a donor, the process is a lot like giving blood. They're able to do it in the same way these days. It's very rare that they may have to do the actual extraction from your hip bone. That used to be the only way to really do it, but that's not the case anymore.
Well, for those who wish to register or find out more, what should
they
do?
Our next event is going to be on Monday, September 22nd from 10 to 2 at the Our Lady of the Lake Heart and Vascular Institute near the lecture hall. But if you want more information and our other dates, you can call us at 225-215-1234, or you can go to mbpolol.org, donor challenge, and you can find out more information.
Renee Duffin, that number again is 225-215-1234, 215-1234. We thank you for joining us today, and are you seeking a specific number?
Our goal is 250.
250. So, and the 22nd, 10 o'clock, you say?
Yes, 10 to 2.
And where?
At the Heart and Vascular Tower at Our Lady of the Lake.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Renee Duffin.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.